Good morning. This is Dallas Townsend with a CBS World News Roundup. For the past several weeks, President Carter has been alleging Cuban military involvement in the recent rebel uprising in Zaire's Xaba province. The charge has been flatly denied by Cuban President Fidel Castro and openly doubted by some members of Congress. Now, intelligence sources have supplied further evidence to bolster the president's allegations, and we'll hear about that from CBS News White House correspondent Bob Schieffer.
According to officials at the policymaking level, here are some of the things the intelligence sources have been reporting. That one rebel prisoner is told of 2 months of intensive training by Cuban instructors last year. That Cubans last year supported the rebels when they invaded Xaba and then supported the rebels when they set up 5 training bases in Angola last summer. That last summer, as many as 6,600 rebels were under what the sources call control of Cuban and East German advisors. That the rebel leader early this year acknowledged to certain parties in the area that his troops had the support of the Angolan government and that the Cubans had been assisting him with arms and weapons training. And that just before this year's invasion, the Cubans were in the process of organizing the movement of large numbers of rebel troops from northeastern Angola toward the Zambian border. CBS News has no way of knowing the reliability of these sources, nor do we know who they are. Only that ranking officials of the administration say they are confident the sources are reliable. Bob Schieffer, CBS News, Washington.
Administration sources say that President Carter has decided to speed up the pace of negotiations with China aimed at full normalization of relations. CBS News diplomatic correspondent Marvin Kalb tells us that the president has reportedly set 3 conditions.
First, that American trade and aid, including military aid to Taiwan, must continue. Second, that when the U.S. embassy closes down in Taipei, a U.S. trade office be opened up. And finally, that the Chinese make it clear in some way that they will not use force to occupy Taiwan. These 3 conditions now have to be negotiated between the 2 countries. If they prove to be acceptable to Peking, the U.S. would then abrogate its mutual defense treaty with the nationalist Chinese and withdraw all of its troops from Taiwan. There are now about 1,000 of them there. U.S. officials say there is no timetable, no deadline for all this, but if the process is to be accelerated, as high officials say, then a deal may be struck by early next year. In part, this is intended to be a strong signal to Moscow that the administration has finally decided to play its so-called China card. Marvin Kalb, CBS News, the State Department.
According to United Press International, Peking has invited Democratic Representative Lester Wolf of New York to visit China for 3 weeks early this summer. Wolf chairs the House Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Affairs and favors full diplomatic relations with Peking. Questions posed by Washington about the future status of the occupied West Bank region and the Gaza Strip remain officially unanswered today in Israel, and Bruno Wassertau reports that they have caused a 3-way split in the Israeli cabinet.
Defense Minister Ezer Weitzman feels that there should be unequivocally positive answers given to the U.S. and proposes that Israel agree to decide the final status of the 2 territories right after an initial 5-year period of home rule. Weitzman also proposes that the area's future be determined by a formula acceptable to all concerned, Israel, Egypt, Jordan, and the local Palestinian population. Foreign Minister Moshe Dayan would like to see most elements of a final status arrangement implemented immediately and a de-emphasis of Egypt's role in matters regarding the West Bank. Prime Minister Begin has not formally come out with his own view, but the suggestion by another senior minister that Israel give vaguely positive replies to the American questions is believed to coincide with the Prime Minister's thinking. In this regard, a story out of Egypt made headlines in Israel today. A government spokesman in Cairo saying that the chances for an Egyptian-Israeli settlement would be better if Ezer Weitzman became Israel's prime minister. Bruno Wassertile for CBS News in Tel Aviv.
Late yesterday, United Nations headquarters registered completion of the first part of its mandate in southern Lebanon, confirming the departure of Israeli forces. CBS News UN correspondent Richard C. Hotelet tells us what comes next.
Now the UN is working on what may be the more difficult second part of its job, helping the government of Lebanon regain effective authority in the south. That depends in the first instance on the Lebanese themselves, on the Christian militia units which were left in charge of most of the border strip when the Israelis pulled out. Their commander, Saad Haddad, is under orders from Beirut to cooperate with the UN peacekeeping force. But Haddad has shown scant regard for instructions from Beirut and open hostility toward the United Nations troops. If he opens the gates to the towns he controls, all will be well. But if he does not, the Beirut government is going to have to assert itself. It has some soldiers to send south who must, however, traverse territory held by the Palestinians. They will have to deal with Haddad. If they are not able to, Secretary General Waldheim and the nations which provide the UN forces will have to decide how much muscle to use to enforce Beirut's writ in the south. Richard C. Hottle at CBS News, United Nations.
Syrian troops of the Arab peacekeeping force are patrolling Christian towns in northern Lebanon, hoping to prevent the forces of former President Suleiman Frangieh from taking revenge for yesterday's killing of Frangieh's son, daughter-in-law, and granddaughter by phalangist militiamen. Frangieh called it a massacre and told his followers it will be avenged by war unto death. More than 40 people lost their lives in yesterday's clashes. Japan this morning remains worried about repercussions from the earthquake that shook large parts of the country day before yesterday. Bruce Dunning reports from Tokyo.
A special investigation team arrived in the earthquake-hit city of Sendai. They came to inspect the three giant oil tanks that ruptured during Monday's quake, spilling millions of gallons of oil into the tank farm in the adjacent Sendai port. Their findings could have a major impact on future energy planning in Japan. The tanks were supposedly strong enough to withstand earthquakes of even greater strength than Monday's, and with epicenters even closer. So the rupture of the three tanks has been a major shock to the government energy planners. The tanks were of the same design used in thousands of oil storage tanks throughout Japan, most of them close to rivers, seacoasts, and crowded population centers. Government officials are worried that the Sendai spill will increase public resistance to oil tank farms. It's especially worrying because the government is trying to expand such facilities to give Japan a 90-day stockpile of oil instead of the present 60-day backlog. This buildup of stocks became necessary after the oil embargo of 1973, but in crowded and earthquake-prone Japan, oil tanks could create a greater danger than had been expected in the event of a powerful earthquake hitting Japan directly. Bruce Denning, CBS News, Tokyo.
The U.S. dollar touched another record low today on the Tokyo foreign exchange market, 216 yen, but closed about 1 yen above that. The dollar is holding firm against the major European currencies. President Carter and India's Prime Minister Morarji Desai got together yesterday and last night at the White House, where Ed Bradley reports that the atmosphere was cordial.
There was an air of warmth at the White House last night. In spite of differences between India and the United States, the leaders of the two countries seem to have struck a personal friendship. In his remarks following the working dinner, Prime Minister Desai said he had struck a common bond with the president.
I find that we believe in the same values. There can therefore be no misunderstanding between us. There can be some difference of opinion on some things. If we did not do that, we will cease to be intelligent. Therefore, that is also a proof of human values.
Some of those differences of opinion will be on the agenda today when President Carter and the Prime Minister take up their final round of talks. Ed Bradley, CBS News, the White House.
Among yesterday's primary election results, Governor David Pryor won the Democratic senatorial nomination in Arkansas, defeating Representative Jim Guy Tucker in a runoff. Pryor faces only token Republican opposition in his campaign for the seat left vacant by the death of Senator John McClellan. In South Carolina, Charles Ravenel was chosen as the Democratic candidate against veteran Republican Senator Strom Thurmond. Ravenel won the Democratic nomination for governor of South Carolina 4 years ago, but was declared ineligible because he hadn't lived there long enough. Republican Governor James Edwards is not eligible for another term, and the Republican candidate to succeed him is former Representative Ed Young. The Democratic nominee will be chosen in a runoff June 27th between Lieutenant Governor Brantley Harvey and former State Senator Dick Riley. In Maine, the race to succeed independent Governor James Longley will be run by State House Republican leader Linwood Palmer and Democratic State Attorney General Joseph Brennan.